special episode for you as we get into the 4th of July week. I talked to Enes Watley, who was the starting point guard on Michael Jordan's rookie year team in 1984, about a month back now, and going to post it today. Enes is 32 years sober, but he was also in the room doing drugs when Michael was a rookie, which was talked about in The Last Dance. Mo Watley, I think you're really going to enjoy this conversation. I just listened back to the whole thing, and so much stuff in here, from growing up during the Civil Rights Movement to playing with Michael to playing with Manute Bol. He's got a sweet Larry Bird story. He played in Israel. Matzo ball soup makes an appearance on this episode. And just one of the good-hearted people that I've come across here. I really, really appreciated the conversation with Enes. Hope you're staying safe out there. Thank you so much for putting on the Windy City Podcast. Let's get right to it as we go to the public address announcer, Tommy Edwards.
And charge from Bama, 6'3", Mo Watley.
The Chicago Bulls, coached by Kevin Lockery in his second year at the helm of the Bulls, a graduate of St. John's University.
11 seasons in the NBA, 150 games with the Chicago Bulls to start it off, and he's been around with Mo Malone in Washington and Dominique Wilkins in Atlanta and the great Portland team, which played the Bulls in the finals in 1992. Enes Watley, great to talk to you. Enes, let's start with the craziness of today and the tragedy of George Floyd and the protests that are going on. I'm just curious your reaction to everything. It's really just a divided and sad time for this country.
Well, you know, I just think that all over, you know, regardless of, you know, like what color you are, you know, I just think that, you know, it's serious times, you know, when it comes down to, you know, someone's life. You know, and I guess the way it went down and everything, you know, it's just unprecedented time. You know, it really is. You know, it's some really, really sad situation. You know,
you grew up in the South, Enes. I mean, I don't know exactly what you experienced as a young guy growing up, but you know, you're born in Alabama in the '60s. What was it like for you?
Well, I tell you, it's amazing that you would say that. I grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, which is downtown. I live in Fountain Heights. And where the bombing took place, where the four girls was bombed in the church, actually my principal at my elementary school was Mr. Robinson. And one of the girls was one of the young ladies that died, you know, in the bombing and everything. But, you know, it was serious time. I was born in the '60s, and you know, in Birmingham, Alabama. Of course, you know the history. You know, down in Alabama, you know, it was a lot different. So, you kind of like, you know, you stayed on your side, you know, and they kind of like stayed on their side. But, you know, for the bombing to take place, you know, at the 16th Street Baptist Church, you know, I was so young at the time. I really didn't understand what was going on, and even by what happened, you know, just recently. You know, it's kind of just kind of putting things in perspective of like this how, you know, disorganized we are and just as a people and just the things that are going on, you know.
So how old were you? We're talking about the 16th Street Baptist Church bombing. I mean, Martin Luther King, he called it, quote, one of the most vicious and tragic crimes ever perpetuated against humanity. 15 sticks of dynamite attached to a timing device on the east side of a church for children. I mean, you were how old?
Yes.
This is 1963, you were really just born.
I was just born, but I tell you what, the elementary school that I went to, our principal, like a certain time every year would come, and he would have tears in his eyes. So we were so young, we didn't kind of like understand. And his name was Mr. Robinson. His daughter is, you know, one young girl that, you know, that was blown up in the bomb. And we was like, why is Mr. Robinson crying? And we were so young, we didn't know, but, you know, we later on found out that, you know, his daughter had died in the bomb. And it was just crazy. You know, you just, you know, didn't understand like why and what, you know, what is going on. Just like, you know, as we speak now, you know, like the why, you know, what is really going on.
Carol Robertson, she was 14 years old. There was Addie Mae Collins, 14, Cynthia Wesley, 14, and Denise McNair, 11. I mean, you went to college at Bama. I mean, different, but, you know, it's still a ways back here now, early, you know, late 70s, early 80s. I'm assuming that it couldn't have been, I mean, you're a special guy on campus, you're on the basketball team, but also, like, what did it feel like to you?
Well, you know, to me, you didn't really understand, you know, like, why and what was going on. But, like, at the University of Alabama, you know, I didn't come through that part. You know, the guys before me, like Wendell Hudson, the first black to go to Alabama and different things like that, he just got his jersey raised, you know, at the University of Alabama. And he would tell some of the stories and everything. But when I was there, you know, it wasn't that bad. You kind of like just know, you know, certain things. Like everyone knows certain things now, but you know, no one really coming forth or no one really doing anything about it.
Did you go to a segregated school growing up, Enos?
No, I didn't. I actually went in Birmingham. We had a north side of town, which is Fountain Heights, where I grew up at. And we considered down in the south where it's called Over the Mountain, where, you know, most of the whites, or wealthy whites, you know, stayed. And I went to like city school, like Phillips High School in downtown Birmingham. It was more on the black side of the town.
Let's jump to the NBA, and you get drafted by the Kansas City Kings, but end up with the Chicago Bulls. And this is the year before Michael, so it's 83-84. And you're playing with a lot of talented guys, but you're coming into a situation where I guess everything is not being done in the most professional manner. How would you describe it?
Well, I wouldn't say not so much in the professional manner, but I think that there was an environment, you know, that was a lot different from maybe, I'm not sure, the other teams, you know, but, you know, with our environment, I turned professional as a sophomore, so I was only 19 going on 20 years old at the time. So, you know, when you're coming into, you know, like a situation like that, you know, you're very young, you know. But I will say, you know, it was definitely a changing experience. Like, hindsight, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I was like, wow, you know, you always wonder if you could have gotten drafted by another team. But I mean, it is what it is. But it was definitely just tough being 19 years old in a big city like Chicago, you know, and being a lottery pick. You know, it was just a tough situation, you know.
Why did you decide coming out after sophomore year? Was that a money thing, or was it more of just I'm good enough to play in the NBA?
That's a great question. I felt at the time, basketball wise, I was good enough. And part of my necessary idols and heroes were, you know, Isaiah Thomas, which is, you know, from Chicago, and Magic Johnson, which they both left at sophomore. You know, I felt that you know, I was ready at the time, you know, to call myself jumping to the next level. You know, at the time, so that's the reason why I left out. Plus, you know, a lot of people don't know, but if you look up my background, it's my dad had 28 kids. And see, my mom had 11 kids by him. So, you know, I wanted to do something for her. I really did. I wanted to do something. I wanted to do nice things for her. She wasn't two jobs at the time. And I just wanted to, you know, just have some money where I could just make her happy while she was on this earth.
Yeah. How poor are we growing up here? And it's like, how would you describe it?
Oh my God! Well, I grew up. I would say, you know, from a huge family in the South. You know, it's, we were poor. We didn't know it, but you know, your mom, you kind of like made the best of what you had. You know, when you cooked, you know, you had beans and cornbread, and you just made it happen. But you know, I had a big family. You know, with my dad had 28 kids and loving from my mom, you know, you just learned to manage life and everything. Yeah.
So what are we breakfast was what?
a good breakfast. Now, my mom was pretty good at cooking. Now, my mother, Andy Morgan, which is a beautiful lady, like in my life, she could make biscuits and grits and eggs. That would be something that was huge down south. You know, one thing my mom could do, she can cook, you know. And, you know, so she would wake up and fix a big breakfast and everything. But, you know, that's what you're looking forward to, especially most black families, you know, to wake up, you know, and just, you know, have a big breakfast, you know, and put some food in your stomach. That'd be a great time right there. You know?
And how many people at that table?
We didn't have too many tables. You know, you caught a seat. You caught a seat where you could, you know. Basically, if you could fit at a table, you know, you sit down. But some people stand up. Some people came in and got their meal. That's the funny thing about, I won't say, you know, in the ghetto and most big families, you know, you come in and get your food and you find your spot and you fit in where you can get in at. Yes.
How many people were sleeping in your room, Enos?
Oh my God, we are. Well, at one time, I kid you not, in my household, it was 22 people in one house at one time. So, like I said, it was three beds, maybe two, you know, to a room. We had a three room home at the time and everything. And man, you learn to come in and you learn to, if the bed was open, you get it. If it was not open, then you got to step. Maybe lay out in the chair and wheel the next place for it.
And that's just normal, right? I mean, this is you're not thinking about there's a kid, I don't know, a couple of miles from here. He's got his own bed. He's got his own room. But that's not even like a thought process.
Well, back then, you know, like I'm born in '62, so you know, like I said, you didn't know at the time that you really was poor, you know, because everyone from where I was from, you know, kind of like had big families, you know, 6, 7, 8, 10 people. You know, in the family, so you think it's normal and everything, but you know that's just the way it was. Like,
yeah. So you get in the league. Do you remember what you were making as a rookie?
Not a fan.
Okay, but so, but regardless, you run in. You know, you're coming from where you're coming from, and now you got this check coming to you. Did you hire a financial guy to help you at that point, or did you just sort of think like you'll figure it out as how, you know, as it went along?
No, you know, you have an agent. You know, of course, you have an agent because Lance Luxner, you know, was my agent at the time. You know, he was the agent I signed with, you know, back when I turned pro. Mm-hmm.
So, how'd you decide that you could trust him?
Well, you just take a chance. You know, like most people do. You know, they take a chance on someone. You know, as they, you know, call, and Lance was pretty, I thought Lance was a pretty good agent. He had a lot of other guys like Maurice Cheeks, myself. They had a lot of guys at the time, but, you know, when I decided to turn pro, you know, he was the agent that I had, you know, and, you know, you just kind of just, you know, you sit down and talk with him and see whether or not you can go, like, where will you go at, you know, and I end up going number 13, and, I end up signing with him, you know.
Yeah. So you're 32 years sober now, Enos, so I want to get that out here first. But, like, going back in time, did you start using drugs in college or was it in the NBA?
Well, I probably at times, you know, experimented, you know, like you know, just say through high school, you know, when you have a drug problem or a drug addiction, a lot of people don't realize it. But, you know, just walking home from football practice really was the first time that I experienced it. You know, we was coming up the alley down, you know, I'm from Birmingham. So we just walking up the alley and God just brought this marijuana out, you know, so, you know, and I tried it, you know, so that just started, you know, a long journey of, you know, drug use, you know.
And then in college, did it escalate from there or did it more escalate in the NBA?
Well, I think that, like I said, I'm 32 years old. It's kind of like, you know, it's coming so quick. I'm trying to just give a decent answer, but I use, like I said, if I can share my testimony, my mom died in '87. My dad died 2 months after she did. So just before that, you know, I pretty much, you know, just kind of like, you know, I used drugs and alcohol, you know, at different times when, you know, just being in. But when that happened right there, that really, you know, kind of like helped me to get my life in order and everything. But, you know, it's times like when you know, when you was play, you know, when you use drugs, you know, you use them, you know, I'm not, you know, sure exactly what time when you use them, you know?
Right. Would you do it normally before games, after games? How would that go in the league?
I just, you know what I'm saying? I just use drugs now. I would like to say that, you know, at this time. Yeah.
Because I remember, you know, story from the Villanova Georgetown ridiculous, one of the greatest championship games in NBA in NCAA history. And I think it was, you know, the guys were using before the game and somehow played, you know, Dwayne McClain played out of his mind. You know, he didn't even know how he did it. But they, you know, but they ended up winning the championship game, beating Patrick Ewing, and you know, one of the great all-time college teams. So I don't know. It seems crazy that it could help you play, but maybe that was the case for some.
Yeah, for some, you know, like you said, when I guess if you're using at the time and you know you're playing, then that's probably tough. When you're addicted to it, I don't think you probably, you know, just select when you're gonna use it. You know, you're probably just addicted to it, can't help yourself. That's what, you know. A lot of times, yeah.
Yeah. When you were explaining with your mom and dad, I thought you were going to say that that's when you kind of spiraled down, but it was actually more brought you got yourself clean at that point. Was that more like to honor your parents, or what would you say?
No, I really got saved, man. I got born again, man. That's what happened. You know, I accepted Christ in my life. You know, my mom I love very much. You know, like I said, it's kind of like a long story. It's kind of, you know, hard to kind of come in and out and just speak about it, because you kind of need a, you know, just the timing part of it. But my mom died of a major heart attack in 87, and my dad died 2 months after she did, you know. And that was, you know, it was a disruptive moment, you know, in my life, you know. And I really, when my mom passed, you know, she was like a very special lady to me, and everything I did was based around, you know, wanting to see my mom okay. And when that happened, you know, it just changed my life. You know, I no matter what path I was on at that time, I never forget the preacher when he preached at my mom's funeral. He said, "Enos, your mom loved you," and he said, "If you want to see her again, you better be born again." And that's when I gave my life to the Lord, and you know, my life started changing now. And that's kind of like, you know, what I go around and do is sharing my story, you know, which I don't mind about being transparent, you know, because of just, you know, just touching someone's life or how my life changed.
I don't know what brought us together in this time here, Enos, because maybe it's The Last Dance and Michael, but just, you know, going back through your career, I've learned, number one, we share a birthday. I was born August 11th, 1973.
Yeah. Are you serious?
I'm serious, okay?
So, wow.
So 11 wow. years after you, I was born, right? And wow. not the same thing here, but just listening to your story. My mom passed away. I was a little younger than when from your mom, but my mom passed away in March of 1987. So I'm just kind of seeing these little odd connections here, you know what I'm saying?
Wow. Are you serious?
I am. March 27th, 1987. I'm never going to forget that date.
That is amazing. That, I don't know if that's a coincidence or what, but that's really, that's amazing. You're born 11. That's amazing.
Right? Right. Listen, it was a Friday morning that she passed, and I was raised on the sort of the privileged side of the street, at least a little bit. And, we had that season, 86-87, the Bulls, they made Sweet 16 tickets available. It was Michael's third year. You had just left, and, or you left, you know, the year prior. And so my dad wanted to give me something. So we got these Sweet 16 tickets. And I'll forever remember that night that the Bulls were playing the Celtics, you know, and my mom passed away that morning. And, you know, I didn't want to think about my mom passing. I wanted to go see Michael play Bird, you know. You don't want to deal with that pain, certainly not as a young kid. But I'll always remember it. They lost that game.
You said they lost that game.
They lost that. I think it was 111-106, which is crazy that I know that score. But, Let's tell a couple NBA stories here. That Bulls team that you came into, Orlando Woolridge was the first poster I ever had up on my wall. I think I went to some game and they gave out these Puma Woolridge posters, so that went up. And Quinton Daly was also a favorite of mine. And these guys were incredible. And yourself, you had yourself and Wes Matthews in the backcourt. I mean, some speedy point guards. That team had a ton of talent. I don't know. you know, and Quinn and Orlando are no longer with us. But what do you remember about those guys? Any story stand out?
Well, actually, Wes came the second year.
Okay.
Wes met Ronnie Lester and Mitchell Wiggins. Me, Mitchell Wiggins, Quinn Daly were the guys that first year. And of course, you know, Reggie was there earlier in the season. Then he was traded to Kansas City and everything. But
Ronnie is one of my favorite guys. He's such a good dude. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. Everybody I hear about, and he was a great guy, like myself, a lot of people say, you know, he was a great guy, even as, you know, I've heard some of his stories. I got a lot of relatives in Chicago, but I've heard a lot of stories about before his injury, you know, how tough Ronnie Lester was and everything. And it's just amazing. But it was me, Ronnie Lester, Quinn Daly, and Mitchell Wiggins were the guards.
Yeah. Who was the most talented?
Concerning who?
In that guard tandem, who was the most talented? You could say yourself, yeah, Enos.
I thought we had, like, before Mike came, I thought we were kind of just starting off. I'm not saying that Chicago was not a winning team. We hadn't established ourselves as a winning team. But I would say between Quinn Daly, Mitchell Wiggins, and myself, we all could play. But I think just as far as trying to establish yourself, you know, that I think that was a big thing there. Of course, you know, about with Quinn Daly, his history, and then, you know, coming in with Orlando Woods and just all those things. But I would have to say, you know, Quinn Daly could score the ball. I still hold an assist record right now in Chicago, which is amazing after Rondo and just so many guys, Derrick Rose and all those guys that played in Chicago. I thought that it probably would have been broken by now. But Quinn Daly, I remember times in games, man. Like I said, I got some. I can talk basketball stories. But I remember times Quinn Daly would go, you know, 8 for 8 and different things like that. Some nights against New York, I think, and against Atlanta, which I got the record on. Man, this guy's like an incredible shooter, man. Just unbelievable. You know, off the dribble. You know.
Yeah. What do you remember about the Michael story? With, you know, he's coming in his rookie year and he's showing up in the hotel room.
Yeah, I never, like I said to you, I never seen Mike in the room. I hear the stories all the time. I'm not sure, you know, what all transpired at the time, but, you know, just hearing it from most people, and just, you know, from media, you know, saying that, you know, Mike came into the room and all the teammates, you know, they're doing drugs. I actually really don't, you know, remember, you know, ever seeing Mike, you know, because, you know, when you come to your hotel, you don't, you know, like we were not friends, like where you come to each other room and everything. So
yeah,
you know, like I said, I didn't remember seeing him at you know, on that time. But I do know that, you know, I know I've been in the room before, you know. So you know, when you're in the hotel room, normally you go in your room, you know, it's your own private time, you know what I'm saying, whatever you're doing, you know.
Yeah, of course. I would, you guys are around each other enough, you would think in your hotel room you're by yourself. Did you ever
right.
get into it with him in practice?
No, like I said, the Michael Jordan, I remember Michael Jordan, which is, like I said, more of a driven, wide-eyed guy. Like, when I'm used the word country, I'm not using it in a derogatory way. I'm just saying that he was just hungry and just, you know, trying to. None of us knew at the time, like, to me, who was going to be what. But I remember him being as Michael Jordan, not the MJ and the things that I see in The Last Dance. I never seen him punch anybody or anything. He was more of a kind of, everyone was just kind of establishing themselves or trying to anyway. He was just a rookie that year, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
So. Tell me about Moses Malone in Washington as you move along to the Bullets, which was one of your best years in the league.
Big Mo, a good friend of mine, first of all. What's your first name?
Mark.
Yeah, okay, Mark. Yeah, Moses was a good friend of mine. He passed away, I think it's been, I'm not sure how many years.
A while now, yeah.
That's, yeah, but I played with Moses and with the Washington Bullets and everything, and we played together. But real good friend of mine, just a heck of a guy, you know, kind of taught me a lot of things about, like on the court, about work habits and just different things like that, man. But he was kind of like in the middle, almost in the prime time of his career, but just an unbelievable guy, man. Just a lot of stories, you know, about him coming out of high school, man. Just, you know, good friend and everything. Yeah.
I remember at the stadium, I'm sure you remember when you would come off the court, you know, you'd walk by the fans behind the bucket, and then you guys would get to the stairs and go down, and they used to have basically no security. So I would come down from the mezzanine, sneak into the boxes, and then I would jump over the hockey board at the end of the game, and I would run to where you guys would come off, and I would try to get high fives from you. You know, that's what a normal kid would do in my mind. So one time I went to the wrong end, so the visitors are coming off, and I think this is like 83. So Moses is a Sixer, and I'm, you know, I'm 10 years old, and I'm not a big kid at all, and I'm also 10. And Moses is walking towards me, and he's unwrapping the tape that he was using for his wrists. And I'm looking up at this guy, and I'm thinking, that is a godlike figure. I've never seen anybody sweat that much. It will forever be in my mind. Like, Moses was – there was something mythical about him almost. Like, he was just a big dude that was just a warrior. I don't know if any of that makes sense to you.
Yeah, he has an unbelievable talent, man. For him to just, first of all, go to the pros out of high school, how they say on the street, they say that was a grown man, you know, at size. So I live in Maryland now, so they were just saying if the University of Maryland could have got him out of college, left to Giselle, you know, they were just saying how good the University of Maryland could have been. But he was definitely a grown man, and I can imagine back in those days, you know, when he was very young and playing with the Houston Rockets, I believe, at that time, man. I mean, this guy was what they call the chairman of the board. He was the original sludgehammer guy on the board, you know.
Was he a gentle giant, or would he kind of put it on you?
Yeah, he would put it on you. You know, he was to me, he could easily go down as one of the top power forwards, you know, to play this game. You know, when you talk about the Maurice Lucas, the, you know, the Buck Williams, the, you know what I'm saying, the Tim Duncans, you know, I think Moses, as far as coming out of high school, man, was probably one of the few guys that established himself as a boysman on the board, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Let's go to your 87-88 Atlanta Hawks team. And then you play with the Hawks later in your career, 93-94. That was a 57-win team. So you play with Dominique when he was young, and you play with him towards the end of his career as well. Like, what stands out about Neek?
Another incredible friend. You know, like I said, I played with so many players. As a journeyman, you get to do that. I have had an incredible life. You know, God's been good to me. But I actually played just like Mike. We go back to college because Dominique played at Georgia.
Yeah.
And I played at University of Alabama. So my freshman year in college, we won the SEC tournament. We had to beat Georgia in order to get there. But unbelievable talent. When you're talking about a human highlight film, man, you got to be kidding me, man. This guy, especially in 87, I was actually with the Hawks three times. That year I replaced John Battle, that year. And I played with the Hawks, and I think I came back 94-95, and with Lenny Wilkins was there for 2 years. But Dominique Wilkins, probably one of the most athletic, exciting guy like Dr. J, that to me, you know, they skill set may not be as talented as Jordan for its fundamental wise, but for its excitement, probably one of the most exciting players to me to play the game, you know.
So I'll make you a general manager, Enos. You can have Dominique for his career, or you can have Clyde Drexler. Who you taking?
That's good. It depends on what I need at the time, but like I said, I play with some great players. If I'm a two guard, I'm taking Drexler, because man, the guy's a winner. You know, I'm not saying I heard it in The Last Dance. You know, Jordan, you know, things he was saying, but Clyde was a pretty heck of a player. Actually, I got drafted one slot before Clyde Drexler. I went 13. He went 14. You know.
Yeah.
And everything, but
it's crazy.
I would take Drexler as a two guard, but also I would take Dominique. Dominique could score the ball, you know. But I'd probably take Drexler at the two spot.
Those are two high flyers right there. What do you remember about playing in? You played in Israel for a year, is that right?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I told you I have an unbelievable story. I played in Givat up toward Nazareth. I played for this team. I played a full year there in Israel. I played for a team that was trying to stay in Division One and everything. When I would kind of like play in the league, and if I didn't make the team, I kind of wanted the first couple guys, not that guys were not going overseas, but I kind of, you know, you went and made money other places, and Israel was one of the places that I went.
Do you like your experience there?
I did. I loved it. I had a great experience. Many times, many people saying I could have easily stayed in Europe and not necessarily, you know, been a star, but, you know, that Maccabi Tel Aviv is also there. I was on a local Kibbutznik team there playing, which we were just trying to stay in Division One. But, you know, you had Maccabi Tel Aviv, you had Galil, you had a lot of top teams that was in Israel. That was pretty good, you know.
It's a different land, man. I've been there a couple times. When you land in Israel, you know you're not home. Let's put it that way.
Now, let me say this right here, because I ended up, when I got married, I had my two sons were very young. Marcus was like probably about maybe, I think he's in the first grade. But I tell you what, I had a great experience over there because I'm a Christian. You know, I know if you're Jewish, you know, that's the opposite side of it. But, you know, I got a chance to go to Tiberias, just go to Jerusalem. So, you know, you got a chance to see just a whole different perspective of life, man. And I actually really had a good time. You know how when you go over there, man, you know, you hear all these things. But I really actually had a good time when I was in Israel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I grew up, I was, you know, raised Jewish and all that. And
sure.
So we... You know, when I had my midlife crisis in my early 30s, Enos, when I quit my job and broke up with my girlfriend, and I'm like, I'm going to go travel for 2 months and figure out what the hell's going to go on in my life. So I stopped. I had a friend who in high school here who was born in Israel, and he had to go back and be in the army. And then he met his wife, and he lives over there. So I'm like, I'm going to go visit this dude. And we were down in Eilat, which is the southernmost point. So Jordan's right there and Morocco and... You know, you are like the whole world is right there, really. And so, you know, I'm on the beach and I'm hearing, you know, straight Southern Christian talk, like, you know, flying from these dudes that are jumping off some raft that's hanging out in the Mediterranean Sea. And I'm like, where are y'all coming from? And they're like, well, it's my church group from Dallas. And it was just cool to see that, you know, you think that the only people that are in Israel are Jews, and that's not really the case. Like, I mean, obviously there's a heavy Jewish population, but people from all over the world over there. So it's cool to hear that you had a great time.
I did, and I remember playing there in the lot called Willie Sims at the time, which was, I played in the SEC in Alabama, and he was like maybe 5 years ahead of me. Him and Ethan Martin played at LSU together, so I ended up going there and playing against him. So, you know, it was a great time. It was a great experience. You know, you hear a lot of things. Well, especially through the Bible, you hear a lot of things, and you get a chance to, you know, to actually go there. Tiberias, I enjoy, you know, Haifa. You know, I wake up, man, had a real nice landlord, Miss Odessa, who I stayed with at the time, man. She just treated me so nice. You know, you just got a chance, speak a little Hebrew, you know, just you know, it was pretty cool. I enjoyed it a little bit. You know, I really did.
Yeah, I know you could hear it here. I speak a little Hebrew. It's kind of amazing. I've never spoken a little Hebrew. Maybe I can do a prayer or two, but I have no idea what I'm saying.
Right. Most Jews either traditionally they're foreign, or they like, man, I don't speak Hebrew. So they like, hey, man, I'm American, or you know, I notice that a lot, though,
right.
You know.
Yeah. I could bust out a shalom and I'll eat a matzo ball soup, but you know that's
yeah. Matzo ball. If you do matzo ball, man, hey, on my corner, a restaurant where I live in Maryland, man, a good friend of mine, Jeff's restaurant. I have matzo ball soup all the time. It's pretty good. You know?
it's not bad, especially when you're sick.
it's good, right?
Yeah, no, it does you right. Let me do. I got so many things that I want to get to here before you go. So we got like 5 minutes here, but let me ask you about three guys. Number one, what do you remember about Minute? Because you got to play with him, and that guy's a straight hero. I don't know if you had any relationship with him.
I did, man. Another friend, man. You bringing up some friends, man. I'm curious. I was in Washington that year, actually, when Moses was there. When Moses came from Philadelphia too, the Bullets. I actually made the Bullets team that year in the new bowl. But just a fun man, fun guy, man. We, you know, he's just hilarious, man. You know, he's passed away too, though. You know that, right?
Yeah, I do. Tragic. And he gave so much back to his people, back to his country. Just a hero, flat out hero, Manute, man.
Yeah, he did. But I tell you, man, we had, I call him Dinky Bowl. he was just a good friend, and he would call me this thing that I can't say, you know, to you, but he was just a fun guy. He's a good guy, man. I miss old Manute, man. I sure do, man. He's a good guy, man.
Do you remember the picture in Sports Illustrated of him being in the pool?
I mean, tell me, food. I think I did see that.
He was in like a, I don't know, 15-foot-long pool, and they had a picture of him, and his arms are extended forward, and it's like, oh my, I got to look that up, but it was a spectacle of like that a man could actually be that tall and that long, and it makes me actually think of, I was in the locker room one time covering when the Spurs were in town, and David Robinson was on one of those Bosu balls, and I was like, all right, all men were not created equal. Like, that dude is 7 feet tall, and he's chiseled, and and I'm sitting here at 5'10". That doesn't all add up, if that makes any sense.
Tell you a little story about Manute. When I was with the Bullets, this is so funny. He had actually what kind of a Chevy truck. We wanted a little, not a 4Runner, but it's kind of like a truck. So Manute was so tall, I kid you not, that they took the seat out. They took their back seat out in order for him to drive, and like, he was not a good driver and everything. So they took the seat out, and man, he used to try to drive to watch his kneecap kind of come up. He could actually reach the paddle, the gas paddle from the back seat of his truck. Man, we would give him a hard time and laugh, man. But his driving skills were not that good. So he kind of like gave it up out there and said he wasn't going to try driving for, you know. Yeah.
I don't know how you can do it. I mean, how your arms got to be on the steering wheel. That's just like, that feels like a high degree of difficulty right there.
Yeah, incredible, man. New good friend, though, but he just tried to drive from the back seat, man. That did not go too well. So he ended up getting, I mean, before Uber really come out, he ended up, you know, he ended up driving back, you know. Yeah. Yeah,
that'd be an interesting one if you're an Uber driver picking up Manute.
Right.
We have to make that work somehow here for you, Manute. What do you got on a Magic or Bird or Barkley story?
I got, like I said, My Bird story is this right here. I'm in the Celtics camp, so they down to 14 players when Brian Shaw was actually, I think, drafted and everything. And I can't think of the big fan of that. Kevin, Ronnie Grunson, and that cute. So I never forget, we played in Milwaukee Bucks. And actually, I think if Larry played in the game or not. So I always say the difference between the two-time the Jordan and the Bird stories. I'm on a two-on-one fast break. We're going back and forth, passing the ball back. And so I hit it because it's Larry. When I played Michael Jordan, I passed the ball. I kind of knew it wasn't going to come back. Jordan probably going to shoot it. But when I'm playing with Larry Bird, and I passed him, he hit a touch pass back to me, and I scored the layup. Never forget, we played the Milwaukee Bucks, and I never forget, he said, "Enos, if you want to make this team, you're going to have to shoot that shot." And a reporter asked him, he said, "Enos Wallace is the best point guard in camp. He may not make the team, but he was like the best point guard at that time." And, man, I kid you not, when I passed the ball to Larry Bird and he passed it back to me, I say it with my confidence, man. I maybe scored 10 or 12 that game, but it was just the idea that, man, Larry Bird passed the ball back to me, man. That just blew my mind, man. I kid you not, man. It was just crazy, man. But Larry Bird was just that type of player, man. I remember in the Chicago days when Larry Bird, like, kind of really all the white guys, Kevin McHale, Danny Ainge, he's kind of a decent friend of mine. I played with him in Portland. They would come out and say, "Hey, Enos, how you feel, man? These white guys coming out here busting y'all up like this, you know?" So, you know, it was kind of like fun. So I never get me Orlando was out. We were just warming up. We were like, what do you mean, man? So, you know, they were just trash talking Mikael and you know, that Bird was just kind of messing with Orlando Woods and everything. But Bird, incredible player, man. He's high on my list, you know.
It seemed like, you know, just watching the body language between Bird and Orlando, that they had, like, some level of respect. Am I reading that right?
I tell you, Cole, I think Orlando kind of is a good friend of mine, too, with Orlando and Larry, because Larry was just such a good player. I think, oh, definitely respect Larry Bird because just his skill set and just man, the guy very – I don't think he underrated, but when they come to talking about clutch shooters and just guys that could flat out was a killer, he would definitely go down in my book as a killer. I say that, you know.
Yeah, as a fan, when I feared Bird more than I feared Magic. I feared Isaiah a ton too. Isaiah was a killer too.
I know we kind of, like I said, you just get it. However, you know, when you're talking about it, but my whole life, Isaiah Thomas kind of like my type of what they call, if you ever had a goal that you had to be set, Isaiah Thomas was that goal that I wanted to get to. I follow, never forget watching him in high school. So, you know, when he went to Indiana, he left out the sophomore. So my whole goal, man, when I first was playing against Isaiah, man, I was a little bit taller than he was. But as far as to me, this is just my barbershop talk. I think he's the best small point guard to play, you know, to play the game and everything. But incredible player. He was like my little idol hero, you know.
Incredible handle, incredible shooter, incredible competitor. I mean, am I missing anything? I don't think so.
No. Can flat out. We talk about Iverson. We talk about Kyrie. We talk about all them guys. But in his heyday, you know, I'm biased a little bit because, you know, like I said, I just believe that I'm not going to put another one small point guard under 6 feet in front of Isaiah Thomas. That's just me, you know.
Yeah, I'm with you. I was having an argument with a friend of mine about it the other day, and he's like, if you look at his stats and this and that, I'm like, you can bring that up all you want. The guy was, you know, and maybe by the time the Dream Team came around, you know, I mean, obviously he was well past it at that point, but historically, he belonged on that team all day long.
I mean, I don't think that, you know, like the political part you can get into and debate, you know, so, you know, that part right there you kind of can get into, but as far as, like, point guard, you know, Stockton was a good guard, too, because Stockton, if from a point guard, I was a playmaking point guard, so I respect John Stockton, too, but I just favored Isaiah Thomas, you know, and he could have easily been on the team, like a lot of other people, like Dominique Wilkins probably could have been on it, you know, just, you know, yeah. other people, but, you know, he could have easily been on it, but definitely Isaiah could, you know, he should have been on it, you know, other than what probably went down, you know.
Yeah. Do you have a Magic story?
Magic, like I said, those were two guys when I was coming out of sophomore, I kind of like was ranked real high as a point guard coming out of Alabama, you know, considered one of the best coming out. And I remember them leaving out, and they was out, Magic was out of the Michigan area. And so, you know, the whole thing is that, you know, to watch him and Bird play beforehand, those were guys and idols that you kind of looked up to at the time, you know, and if anybody seen Magic Johnson play, who wouldn't want to be like Magic and everything? But I really, you know, I like Magic was 6 feet, I guess eight, and I was more of a small point guard. Right. I think I had some pretty, you know, decent games, you know, against him. But he was, like I said, other than being one of the best, you know, that's all the story that I have. That, yeah.
Yeah. So, Ines, where can people find you? I know you do speaking, and you've been helping people a ton, I guess, talking and trying to get people on the right path like you were able to do in your life, 32 years sober, and congratulations on all of it, and I really, really, really appreciate the time today. But how do people catch up with you?
Well, you know, normally, like I said, since I've been married and, you know, actually I became a grandfather yesterday. I became a grandfather.
Wow, yesterday?
Yeah, yesterday I became my son. My son played Enos Jr. He plays in Italy, and he actually had a daughter yesterday, Enos Maria. Yeah, but I do a lot of public speaking, you know, like just sharing my story, you know, sharing my testimony and everything. But I kind of go around probably all over working with the Wizards. I worked down with the Washington Wizards alumni, Monumental Sports and everything. Kind of just going around, that's what I kind of do,
Okay. Well, if anybody wants to get in contact with Enos, I'll help you point in the right direction. And I'd love to see you back in Chicago to do some, do a talk one day too. That'd be awesome to have you back in the city.
If we have a man, just keep it numb and everything, man. We're around, man. Appreciate it. We'll stay in contact, man, and that'll be cool,
Yeah, absolutely. It's been great connecting with you, and I've really enjoyed it. And thanks for sharing all your stories and, the vulnerable stuff too. It's been a pleasure.
I appreciate it. Okay, thanks.
Time to bring in everyone's favorite, Ethan Blumenthal, as we look ahead to the baseball season. Ethan, you love baseball, but do you love the new rules? I, for one, despise them, at least some of them. So we might be on the same side here, but I'm not sure if we are. How do you feel about the designated hitter? I feel like we've talked about this. We did, didn't we?
Well, I don't know if we talked about it. So I think that the whole wackiness of the season is kind of leaning into it and saying, let's see how crazy we can get. And it just gets crazier and crazier once you start talking wet rag, so that's, that's definitely the most hilarious thing there. But in terms of the DH, I think that people aren't, not as much uprising about it because people aren't sure if it's going to stick. I kind of feel like once they do it, they're going to be like, yeah, we're going to stick with it. And so I do think it's going to, be around. I go back and forth on the DH, but if you have a strong opinion, I'd love to hear it.
Well, when you think about the Cubs, the National League team in this incredible city that we're so fortunate to live in, what are the greatest moments in Wrigley Field history? Anything come to mind?
The greatest moments in Wrigley Field history?
Yep. What comes to mind?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that comes to mind. I mean, are we talking about pitchers hitting? Is that what you want me to bring up?
Because I don't. You can. The number one moment here. I'll give you my top three moments in Wrigley Field history. Number one, when they beat the Dodgers to go to the World Series, and you were in the park that night, it was a biblical experience. I mean, people were weeping. They were so damn happy. And I walked around and interviewed the fans, and people were saying that this was better than the birth of their children. Like, that was a universal take. It was such a relief that they had gotten to the World Series. So that was like the end of the Dodgers series I would put up there. Montero's homer in game one of that series was bananas.
Yeah,
straight bananas. And so that's up there. But then my other one, Kerry Wood, game seven, down two outs, 3-2 pitch into the left field bleachers. And I don't know if you were there that night. You probably weren't.
I wasn't there, but I know exactly what you're talking about. I believe the year was 2003 for those people who didn't quite catch that
right
enough at home.
Right. It was incredible. And then if you go back, deeper in my 11-year-old childhood part, Rick Sutcliffe hitting a homer in 1984 was sweet. When pitchers hit a home run, when pitchers do anything, when John Lester goes deep, it's awesome. So I'm a fan of the pitcher hitting. I like double switches. I like strategy. I don't need another masher to be up there to do the same thing that every other single at bat is trying to do.
I like the fact that that half of the league does it the opposite way, where they don't have the pitcher bat. I mean, that to me is kind of, it seems just silly. So that seems silly. Now I have seen one take. And hear me out to see if you like the way this can happen. Is instead of having a DH the whole time, the DH is only in the game so long as the starting pitcher is in the game. So as soon as the starting pitcher leaves, the DH is then also removed from the game. So then that kind of still has, if you want some of that, crazy double switching that can happen, that can still be a part of the game. How do you feel about that?
I actually don't know. I almost would prefer it being the vice versa, that once the starting pitcher leaves, you can bring in the DH. I don't know. I've never thought that one through. That's interesting. But I don't. Look, I would like it to be universal, no DH. But at least we have the National League style of baseball, and I kind of liked that there was a little differentiation, a little splitting of the leagues. It was a unique thing. And I don't know why we had to have as part of the negotiations here that we'll give you the DH. It just, first of all, they never had an agreement anyway, so why do we have to go to this? And now all of a sudden pitchers can't hit? Why? It doesn't make any sense to me.
You know, can I tell you that it's never quite made sense to me why pitchers have to generally be bad at hitting? Because the fact is these pitchers, for the most part, they were hitting and probably the best players on their teams, at least through high school. And then they probably, and I'm sure they were not only the best pitcher, but they were also the best shortstop and the best hitter and all of that. And a lot of them probably hit in college too. I mean, I know that pitching is this all important thing, but I never understood, why don't they take some more at bats? Why don't they work on their swing a little bit? Not their main thing, but why do they have to bat 150?
Right.
So is there a reason that they have to?
We're in agreement here. What do you think of the extra innings? There will be a runner on second base to start each half inning if it goes to, you know, the 10th inning. So we'll play somebody out there, and it's actually, just so people are aware, it's going to be who's ever in the batting order immediately preceding the last half innings, you know, last out. So the leadoff hitter in that inning, that's who goes out to second base. So it could be your, like, whatever. It could be for the Cubs, it could be Chris Bryant all of a sudden is on second and he doesn't get a chance to take the ball to the ballpark.
Right. So here's what I think about that. I think clearly if they ever tried to do something like that at any point in the game during a regular season, I would definitely be up in arms. For this, I mean, why the hell not? As far as I'm concerned, they could have a home run derby. They could have a race. They could have, you know, the two slowest relief pitchers try to, you know, run around the warning track to see if one of them just can make it without falling down. I mean, there's all sorts of things that I would be happy to see, and I don't really care because this season is kind of up in the air. And I'll also just say my bold prediction right here on this podcast is that there is not a 60-game season that is played. I don't really see it happening with this whole, you know, it was all about money like a week ago, and realistically it's still all about that little pandemic thing that's still going on.
How many games do you think they play?
So it wouldn't shock me if they didn't play any, and they, in spring training, the players started to get it, and they were like, we just can't do this. This is not going to be possible. So that wouldn't shock me, but I'm going to say under 20 games.
Yeah, I said on the radio show over the weekend, 6 to 10 Saturday night, WGN Radio, I said the White Sox would finish 6-2 and the Cubs would finish 4-4. So, let's go with 8. I hope I'm wrong, and I do think that even if things get real kind of dicey, I think they'll continue to push on. But when half a team tests positive, then we're going to have trouble.
But, I mean, when the Angels are playing and Mike Trout and Shohei Ohtani both have coronavirus and they're quarantined for 14 days, that's 2 weeks. One of them, you know, it's 2 weeks that they can't be out there. That's, you know, almost half the season, a quarter of the season. You know, Anthony Rizzo, Chris Bryant, they're done for 2 weeks. I mean, who wants to watch the Cubs play 60 games when half of their games are going to be played without some of their key guys? Yep. I just feel like that's going to happen.
It'll be very interesting to, when all the players get to camp and are tested, how many actually test positive? Because guys don't know. They could very well be asymptomatic carriers. You don't know. So
the other fun rule, I don't know if you read deep enough into that, but that managers will be subject to suspensions if they come within 6 feet of the umpire when trying to argue a call. Now, the whole arguing with the umpire is kind of a lost art anyways, because now you can just challenge the play, you know, which kind of ruins that whole situation. But I kind of think, and hear me out here, in order to make, you know, they've done like all-star games where they mic the players up, or spring training games, and that's always kind of fun. But why don't we give the managers a megaphone And then they can just kind of stand from 20 feet away and just shout at the umpire everything they want to say. And then we all get to hear it and get to be entertained by that. That just adds another element to the game. What do you think about that?
Phenomenal idea. Completely into it. You can walk out to the designated megaphone, yell at the umpire area,
yeah,
and have at it. Let's go.
Yeah. And then everyone gets to hear it. And then we're all part of that. And I think that realistically that should go for any, you know, I mean, let's mic up the coaches. You know, let's see what's really the nastiest things that's coming out of those mouths.
And I think, well, I'm just excited to hear, okay, we're gonna mound visits and y'all are not, you're supposed to keep social distancing. I'm fired up for those conversations. I mean, maybe we're going to have fans in the stands, maybe we're not, but most likely, even if we do, we're going to be able to hear what's being said. Listen, motherfucker.
It's true.
You know?
It's true. Yeah, we are going to know, because there's no going to be any fan noise. And I didn't see that. I saw some sports, they were talking about pumping in fan noise. Are they going to do that with Major League Baseball? Did you say anything about that?
I think that they might. I don't think they should. I'm down with a nice, peaceful... Yeah. You, I don't know. Maybe it'll feel very jarring, but I'm cool with it. Little whatever, birds chirping in the background, whatever's going on. If I can hear the L riding by at Wrigley, or I guess same thing at Guaranteed Rate. Maybe we can get a little shot of the Dan Ryan. I'm good.
I agree. I think the first game it'll be like, whoa. But you remember that White Sox game that they played a few years ago in Baltimore, where there was no one there.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know. The other thing is they're not allowed to high five each other. The players are not allowed to high five each other. And so I don't know if you, but I think back in 2016, David Ross, who's now the manager of the Cubs, he came up with the David Ross dick bump. So you know what I'm talking about? Where they just kind of like rubbed crotches with each other. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, a little bit. It was an aggressive thrust situation.
Yeah, it was a thrust. It was a thrust. It was a man-to-man, just two dudes hanging out, having fun, and just touching dicks together. And so I think that is going to kind of come back and go league-wide. And I think that could, you know, when you think about players as role models for kids, I think that could be interesting to see where society goes when instead of high five, we just replace him with the David Ross dick bump. So I think that's an interesting thing to watch out for.
Yeah, I'm not exactly certain that there was ever any touching of the region.
Take a look. You type that in right now, and you'll see. They're thrusting, and they're touching. I think they're touching. I mean, as far as I understand it, and from what I remember watching, it looking like there was touching going on. Now there are cuffs, you know, so there are cuffs really protecting the specific region. But I think that could be coming back big time.
I mean, all right, I'm gonna have to look at some video here, but I don't remember it being quite that close. But hey, maybe they, you know, no pun intended, got a little bit excited in the moment. So you mentioned the wet rag, which for those who are not following along at home, notwithstanding, all pitchers may carry a small wet rag in their back pocket that's to be used for moisture in lieu of licking their fingers. Water is the only substance that is allowed on that rag. Pitchers may not access the rag while on the pitching rubber and must clearly wipe the fingers of said pitching hand dry before touching the ball or the pitcher's rubber. So you've got thoughts on this?
I think it's just when I saw just the, you know, carry a wet rag, it's just, I don't know, it just sounds funny to me. I think it's fine. I think I saw something else about that they're in batting practice, they're only going to use those balls once, and then the balls they use are going to be sanitized and won't be able to be touched for 5 days. So I just think that there is a lot of these things that are going to be kind of silly. I mean, I just, you know, I don't know how much that's going to help. What are they going to do when Kyle Hendricks steps on the bump and he licks his finger and then wipes it on his pants? Are they going to throw him out of the game? I mean, what do you think is going to happen?
I think they're going to kick him out of the league.
Forever. Maybe kick him out of the United States of America. Maybe that's that.
You're done. It is interesting what they're doing with the actual baseballs and how You know, very few people are allowed to touch the baseballs. Players should keep and use their own personal equipment whenever possible. Any baseball that is put in play and touched by multiple players shall be removed. And then they continue on. After an out, players are discouraged from throwing the ball around the infield. And then fighting and instigating fights are strictly prohibited. Can you imagine if we had a bench-clearing brawl?
Yeah.
And then along those, the duties normally handled by bat boys and girls will be performed by existing club staff. Other than balls stored in an Arizona's humidor, clubhouse staff are prohibited from handling game or practice balls without washing their hands and without wearing face coverings and clean gloves. Individuals must use clean tap water or drinking water to supplement rubbing. It's a lot of attention on the baseball there, Ethan.
Yeah, a lot of attention. And I think I want to get back to your point about the all-out team brawls. I think it would be really funny because obviously, you know, the guys would be like, listen, we want to fight you. We're really pissed. You just hit our guy, whatever it may be. But maybe they can have a fight and somehow use projectiles. I'm thinking maybe a nice clean game of dodgeball. And so everyone's, you know, socially distanced, and they're just slinging those hard rubber dodgeballs, the ones that you used to play with, not the little foamy ones they play with now. And they just go at each other, and then they get to take out that aggression, have a quick 5-minute dodgeball break, throw some stuff at each other, and then we can socially distance and still have the brawl. What do you think about that?
Not bad. I was thinking maybe you have a 5-minute timeout where everybody can get to their locker and get on their computer and get on a Zoom call, and then on the Zoom call, everybody can scream at each other. What do you think of that? Like a Zoom brawl.
Yeah. A Zoom brawl, yeah. I think we might be able to use some technological way to skip the whole having to go into the locker room. But yeah, I like a little Zoom brawl. And then, of course, again, that should all be broadcasted so we can hear everything that's going on.
Right, right. It's a Zoom. Maybe you can do it right there in the – well, it'd be challenging with the social distance in the dugout situation because that's not going to be easy. But, you know, I don't know if you – I mean, these guys, James McCann of the White Sox, and a lot of them are – they're freaked out by the non-spitting. You know, this is something they've been doing forever, and now I can't spit. It's second nature. It's like, you know, putting on your cleats and,
yeah,
you know.
There's no spitting sunflower seeds or anything. You can't. There's none of that. And I think, to me, it's like the natural reaction walking onto a baseball field. For some reason, you walk onto a baseball field and you just want to spit. That's just how I feel. I pick up a baseball glove and I throw a ball and I spit. It's a natural thing. I think that's going to be so hard to enforce. And then what are they going to do? They're just going to hand out warnings and then they're going to have to suspend someone for spitting at some point. I mean, it's going to be crazy.
Yeah, I do think at the end of the day, this is a good thing. Stop being a disgusting freaking human being and learn to control yourself. You don't need to spit every 5 seconds because you're standing out at shortstop or in left field or at the plate. Just control yourself like a civilized human and keep the saliva in the old mouth. I don't think it's a terrible adjustment for baseball, but I do agree at the same time that it's going to be a big challenge for these guys because they've been doing it literally their whole lives.
Exactly. Now, another element to this, and I don't know if you – so are some stadiums going to have fans? Is that what I'm seeing, that they're going to have like 20% capacity?
That's being proposed. We'll see.
So let's assume that that doesn't happen. And then I know I've seen that, I think, in a game in Korea, they fill the stands with
– cardboard cutouts?
Well, cardboard cutouts, and there was also dolls or stuffed animals, you know, stuffed toys, whatever. And then I know I saw something, there was like an opera where they put plants in the stands. So I'm thinking, do you have any thoughts about what kind of things we could put in the stands to fill the stands that aren't people?
I personally would just like a lot of Jordan posters, different eras, different games, maybe with some stats.
The Cubs game and the Sox game.
Yeah, really at any baseball stadium all across the league. You know, Mike is universal. I'm thinking
that the home team should really troll the away team. So let's just say, for example, that you're playing the Red Sox come to Wrigley Field. I know that's not going to happen, but the Red Sox come to Wrigley Field and you just have 40,000 cutouts of the baseball going between Buckner's legs.
That's not
and
bad.
So, but then, so every Boston fan, they're just, the Cubs are just trolling them. And then they can do the same thing. Cubs go somewhere and they can put, you know, the image of Moises Alou reaching up into the left field stands, or they can put a Billy Goat, you know, whatever they want to do.
Pictures of picture of Bartman, right. Picture of Alex, right. Gonzalez, pictures of, right. Leon Durham and his Gatorade glove, and whoever else. We can go get the black cat out from 69. Not, right. Bad. I hate that you invoked Billy Buckner, one of my all-time favorites. R.I.P. Billy Buck. But yeah. That was a moment in Red Sox history. Can never live it down.
And every team's got something, not to that extent, but I think we could, you know, teams could get creative and then and have some fun trolling the other team and then really piss off the fans. And then everyone's having fun because then they're into it. Then they're like pissed off. They're like, I can't believe those jerks over there did that. And then we have a whole, then we kind of bring the competitiveness back to the forefront, and then we're having fun again.
Then we're having fun again. Ethan, it was fun to be with you, brother.
Can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
This is non-baseball related, okay?
Go for it.
So I saw this on Instagram. So you have one opportunity, one attempt to do one of the following things, okay? This is for you, for Mark Harmon, okay? Either you can shoot a layup and make $50,000. You can shoot a free throw, make $100,000. You can shoot a jump shot from the top of the key, $500,000. A wing three-pointer, $750,000, and a corner three for $1 million. You only get one attempt. So either you can say, okay, I'm just going to take the easy $50,000, or you could do something else. What would you do?
A corner three for $1 million?
Yeah, and let's assume, I'm going to assume that we're talking NBA three here.
You're telling me that I can shoot a corner NBA three for $1 million. I'm shooting that shot.
Now, if you miss it, you get nothing, but if you shoot a free throw, you could still walk away with $100,000. I'm just...
Right. I would say that my percentage likelihood of hitting the free throw is 50-50. I'd say the layup is 8 out of 10 in, with that much pressure, you know?
You think 50-50 on the free throw, you're a 50% free throw shooter?
With however much money you put on the line, yes. It could go either way. So, okay. And I think from a corner three... I'm probably, I don't know. Give me, I think I'm probably at 20%. I think roughly. I'd be practicing it. So I think I would feel comfortable. It's gonna hit the rim. It's just a matter of, you know, am I gonna shoot it? Am I not gonna leave it short or shoot it long? So I'd shoot the corner three. Let's go for $1 million. I mean, $50,000 would be sweet, but. It wouldn't completely change my life. If I banged down $1 million, now we're talking.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, obviously that's where I would go to because I'm a home run hitter and, you know, we've had conversations before where you punch and where I would go for it. So I just thought, you never know. But I'm with you there. I would go for the corner three because the corner three, it's $1 million. That changes your life. The $50,000 is awesome. Doesn't necessarily change your life, exactly. So that was my thought process, too. I just so maybe get practicing, and we can see if we can find someone, some rich person to take us up on this.
Well, let's flip it around. I'll do it differently. $10,000 for the layup, $100,000 for the free throw, $250,000 for a three, and half court is $1 million. What are you doing?
I would go... I'd probably go $250,000 for the three. Anyway, I can shoot the three from anywhere. Doesn't really matter, but I would,
you can shoot it from wherever you want, baby.
Yeah, I would go for the three. I've done half court shots enough where I've sat in the gym and just taken a bunch of them, and I truly do think, and we can go out there and I can prove it to you that I think I can hit 20% of those. But I think that I can wide open three. I think I can hit much closer to the 40 to 50%. So I just. Those odds are way better.
All right. Well, when the pandemic is over, let's get the video crew out there because I don't think you're hitting 40% of three-pointers if we're talking NBA range, even if we're talking college range. But maybe you are. I don't want to sell you short, Ethan Blumenthal.
So can I tell you my all-time greatest, and I hope that there's people there and they can go and try to look this up, okay? But my greatest feat in all of my entire athletic career is I went to Jones College Prep High School, and when I was a senior – We in the Illinois State High School basketball tournament, they also have a 3-point shooting contest. Okay. And to go downstate, to go to Peoria, Illinois, to shoot in the three-point contest to, you know, win the state three-point shooting contest,
yeah.
I had to face someone who's currently in the NBA and played in Chicago. Do you know who that person is?
Michael Finley?
No, Michael. No, I was. So this would have been in 2010.
2010. He was in high school and you were in high school?
Yes.
Okay, let me think about this. 2010. He was 18. That means he'd be 28 now. Michael Finley was a terrible guess.
that was an awful guess. Yes.
Yeah. 2010. So can't be Derrick Rose. He was already about to win an MVP. So it's got to be younger.
He's really good. He's probably one of the top five players in the NBA right now.
Top five player out of Chicago. Anthony Davis?
Anthony Davis. Went to Perspective Charter High School. And they were terrible, by the way. But I remember we were sitting there watching before our game, and we would have played Anthony Davis' team. We would play Perspective, except that they were really terrible. We watched his game in the first half, and we were just counting. He had like 20 blocks, 20 points, and 20 rebounds in the first half of, you know, a high school game where you only play like, you know, 14 minutes in one half. So it was pretty fun to watch. But I did beat him in the three-point shooting contest to go downstate in Peoria. So there's my story.
Based on that story, I think Anthony Davis is going to sign with the Bulls when he becomes a free agent. I'm very excited.
I agree. And then when he's sitting there on the court, he'll point me out and bring me on the court,
right,
and he'll say, this guy beat me. And then hopefully he'll give me some money or at least give me a high five or whatever.
And talk about how he always listens to the Windy City podcast, especially when Ethan Blumenthal is dominating, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep, there it is. All right, brother. Good to be with you. Happy 4th of July week.
You too, man. Take it easy and always a pleasure.
I'm going to leave it right like that. Good work, brother. Half hour.